Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And this weekly we journey over the mountains to the Limerick village of Kilfinan, which hosted the second annual Hearsay International Audio Arts Festival last weekend. DJ and record label boss Giles Peterson will guide us through the unearthly music of Sun Ra, and we'll bend the ear of Professor Aisling Kelleher about the dark but possibly essential arts of data obfuscation. But before we pry into the darkest regions of the internet, we'll take a walk down Main Street, Kilfinan, County Limerick. Over the weekend, Kilfinan in County Limerick became an unexpected centre for a band of brothers and sisters who self-diagnose variously as audio nerds, radio heads and podcast addicts, along with a universe of stars you'd only recognise if you heard them speak. The second Hearsay International Audio Festival took over village venues from the convent to the priest's house, as well as vacant retail premises on Main Street. In the latter, Sound Happening set up shop offering everything from an ephemeral vinyl trio to a hardware store of sound stories and a salon offering prints of your acoustic autograph. Culturefile brought its microphone.
But yeah, the higher you do it,
like, do a really high one, they're more interesting, aren't they?
Well, it was originally thought up by a lady, a Scottish soprano singer called Margaret Watts Hughes, W-A-T-T-S, Hughes, in 1875. And she wanted to see how long she could hold a note, but there were no means of recording. And so she created basically what is a drum with a pipe in it. She put sand on the top, and depending on how long she could hold that pattern, which nearly always had symmetry, she was then able to record how long she could, you know, sing. In this one here, I've created the shape of the alphabet. I've taken some sounds from animals, whale sounds, to see the shape of the whale sound, bird song, a whole variety of things.
How does this happen, though? How are these patterns created?
Well, it's just the tone of your voice. And it's a bit like when I'm speaking to you, it's resonating on your eardrum and sending a signal to your brain. Instead of the sound going to your brain, it's showing visually the shape of that sound. And there's a whole area to do with sound called cymatics. And there's a guy called Hans Jenny, who was a Swiss doctor who had a great interest in sound. He kind of coined that name, cymatics, which has its basis is from chyma, meaning wave, sound wave. But he really can't take all the credit, because Margaret Watts Hughes, had she been a man, would have been, there'd be a statue of her in the middle of Edinburgh somewhere, you know. So I'm a great promoter of Margaret Watts.
You're going to get that sorted out, though, are you?
Well, I'm hoping to. I'm going to do a PhD on that one, you know, maybe.
That's how they get their statues, PhDs.
So here we have the idophone, which is basically a pipe. And I'm putting some black sand on top of it, on top of the latex membrane. Now, depending on the thickness of the membrane, the heat in the room, they're all different things that will affect the patterns that come out. A higher pitch sound, you do get a more interesting pattern.
I'm quite good at high screechy sounds, actually.
Are you good? Look at it, you go.
And you've got a beautiful rose appeared there momentarily, and now it's a couple of concentric rings.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Hearsay in the Dark Story Store. We've got lots of things up on our shelves. We've got very random things, actually. A pair of swimming flippers there, a kind of mystery object. We've got some local produce down here, a rubber chicken, some teddy bears over there. It's a bit of a crazy mismatch. And what you'll see is that each of these objects has a little tag attached to them with a slightly cryptic sounding name on it. I'm looking at a hammer here that has Mr. Fix-It written on it. There's a little plate here that says
as it lives and breathes.
We've all come here from Bristol. We're the Bristol branch of In the Dark.
So how did you end up in this hardware store in the main street in Kilfinnan then?
We wanted to do something slightly different, and we had this idea to do a story store where people could come and buy stories but also pay with their own stories. So we've been recording people's stories, particularly some of the locals who remember this store when it was in its heyday, you know, in the last 50 years. So the last week there's been a lot of sweeping and cleaning and getting this place ready, but it looks sort of ragged but slightly spectacular. It's really, really beautiful. There's an old counter, old sweet jars.
The thing I love about it is that they're almost all empty. The nice sounding sweets are all gone, the butter nuggets and the Tribor extra strong, but the clove rock jar is completely full still.
Nobody wanted any clove rock. It is completely solid. Well, I suppose rock's supposed to be solid, isn't it?
Well, we have a look inside then.
Yeah. Let's go in.
The upholstery store, we'll just go in.
Yeah.
You've got one very well-positioned chair, a nice comfy armchair, and three little record players with a tiny spinning black disc on them.
Mechanically, what's happening is you've got three turntables that are unsynchronized with three acetate dub plates with the same material pressed on each one. And just by randomness, by putting them on and pressing play, because they're unsynced, each time it's played, it will be slightly out of sync, and will, because of the composition process that was involved in making the music, it'll be slightly different each time. It's just these small little phrases with the space in between them to hear the surface of the record, you know, that vinyl quality you get. Because this is a finite material, ultimately, if we just left them on playing, the needles would destroy the music, so it would almost decompose itself over a period of time. So it's very, very soft plastic. So every time it is played, it's slightly destroying itself, I suppose. So it's not going to last. I like that as well.
Have you ever seen a record player before?
Yeah. At my nana's house.
Shows how old I am.
Do you think it'll catch on?
No.
I think it's great. I think it's really beautiful. Like the music itself is very beautiful, and the I think when you come from a world of sound design and filmmaking, and so much of your work is from a combination of trying things out and thinking things through greatly. Serendipity does play a part in all creative processes, and this, I suppose, takes that serendipity and brings it front and center in a really beautiful way. Things being lost, things being destroyed, is something that's very much part of the world, but we tend to forget it now in a world where everything is archived, everything is saved, theoretically at least. So something that embraces its own finitude, is that a word? Is quite has a kind of a melancholy that speaks to the melancholy of the music. So it's very coherent. I think the whole thing adds up to a very coherent and melancholic, poetic experience. So I'm heading out the door of this upholstery shop with a tear on my soul.
Tiger Sullivan there, ending that report from the Hearsay 2015 Audio Festival. And you also heard from vinyl addict Jimmy Eady, Bristol's In the Dark audio collective, and audio autograph hunter Grace Digney. In the dark ages, say before 2001, the only one who ever saw everything was God. But now every surface you touch, knows, and shares with selected partners and the NSA your deepest, darkest browser histories and much, much more. But a growing field of artists, academics, and technologists is aiming to regain a click or two of privacy. I asked our tech correspondent, Professor Aislinn Kelleher, about the growing field of data obfuscation.
Yes, I do think it's probably about time that we as a kind of a general public began to think a little bit more deeply and maybe more proactively and aggressively about dealing with the amount of tracking and surveillance that been done on us as a populace. For example, there's a huge asymmetry in power between those who are being tracked and those who are doing the tracking. We don't know exactly how we're being tracked. We don't know what's been done with information that's been retrieved in this situation. And more particularly, we have no idea how it's going to be used in the future. So right now, whether it's camera surveillance out in the street or companies or even governments tracking our search history and what we're doing, our mobile location, using GPS data, what our cars are doing, there's huge amounts of inferences being made about who we are and what we're doing, whether we're up to good or bad. And we need to really begin to think about, is there a way that we can inject ourselves, put some control in there and kind of go back to maybe some of the earlier times understanding about what it means to be a private citizen, a private individual, that it means that you have, essentially, shouldn't you have the right to be left alone? And if we don't even know if we've been left alone, as the Edward Snowden has kind of brought to our attention, then, you know, it's really time for the population to kind of wake up a little bit and perhaps think about, are there even low-level strategies that we can adopt to begin to take a little bit more control of our data and, you know, information about our activities?
But there is this assumption that if we take too much care with our information, then that's a suspicious behaviour in itself.
There's a whole slew of different ways you can think about, well, there's kind of the obvious ones. There could be technical strategies that we should adopt, or there should be legal strategies, or perhaps, you know, corporations or government entities, they should be the ones who are kind of taking the lead and kind of adopting a more ethical stance in what it is that they're about. And all three of those are maybe possible, but they still kind of invoke their own challenges, whether or not they might take a long time to do in the case of the law, or they might just, in the face of competitive advantage, why would a company do that? And technically, when you adopt a technical solution, often that is maybe very difficult for the general population to participate in, or something that only the technical elite. So I think one of the ways that people talk about it is through this idea of data obfuscation, which could be considered as the weapon of the week. Okay, so the idea that for those of us who don't necessarily have huge technical chops or are not part of a legal kind of push towards this, what are some of the really simple, normal, everyday strategies that we can use to begin to protect our own privacy? So data obfuscation is essentially how do you kind of hide the original data and mask it by the addition of kind of other random information that has either nothing to do with that original data or just kind of creates a cloak around it. So one example would be, many of us are familiar with using loyalty cards at the grocery store, or actually now they're kind of endemic, they're everywhere in all sorts of arenas. So instead of, you know, this loyalty card being just attached to you as an individual, perhaps you could share it with many other families, share that kind of the barcode or the information on that, so that you and perhaps a house that's full of 20 students, or, you know, a family next door or a whole neighborhood could share this one card. So you're still reaping the benefit of, you know, getting cheaper groceries or getting 2-for-1 deals without giving up, you know, your own privacy, or without the idea that there's now massing a database that has a really clear understanding of everything you buy, that you're clearly on a diet, you know, that maybe you're after going through a big breakup and you're eating a lot of cake and alcohol, that, you know, that there's all sorts of inferences that can be made about you that can be made much more difficult by this very, very simple strategy.
There's online and offline tracking. And one of the things that's happened with the offline tracking is that where a lot of technology, as you say, is tracking our faces around the street. Now, some countries have made it illegal to cover your face in certain circumstances. So very quickly, from just messing around with corporate entities, you kind of leave this piece and head into the world of illegality, it seems.
Yes, this sense of that. Do we have, you know, in making certain things illegal, it seems that they're trying to put in the onus on the public, that we have some sort of moral or ethical obligation to share our data. For example, Mark Zuckerberg has talked about it, that it's a complete social norm to share your information. And I get concerned about that. I'm like, since when did it become a social norm? Since when should I just walk around and eagerly offer my face up to be tracked? It's like the same when you walk into large department stores and they use the strategy of showing you monitors so they can kind of make it very, very evident to you as you walk in, you are being tracked, you are being surveilled. I think there are some intriguing, I guess you could call them art projects that people are doing to think about, well, are there very kind of, again, analog strategies that you can use to circumvent these kind of face tracking software that's been used on cameras? So, for example, artist Adam Harvey, who's kind of an expert in this area of surveillance, he's developed this very intriguing strategy that combines fashion and makeup technologies. In this case, it's called CV Dazzle. And he has this fabulous lookbook that you can access online that tells you how to kind of create very avant-garde looking makeup on your face, very asymmetric hairstyles. For example, that you can walk around, you look maybe like you've just come from Fashion Week, or you look like you're dressed up as David Bowie for Halloween or something like that. But either way, you look rather unusual. You still look like a human, but to a camera, because of the shapes that you've put on your face, it's not identifiable as facial features. So this is one way that he's been developing to try and be like, you know, you have the right to walk around, to look fantastic and, you know, amazing, and also to be non-detectable to a non-human source, in this case, to a camera. So I think that's kind of one example. In this case, it's obviously not for everybody and very few people are going to do it, but it does more particularly draw attention to the fact that these cameras are not there necessarily just to protect merchandise. They're there to really draw a lot of inferences about you as you walk around a store, or peruse it and look at things, pick things up and put them down. All of that information is incredibly valuable to corporations in trying to think about how they can sell you more stuff.
One of the prophets of this area was Helen Nissenbaum, who was involved in creating a piece of software to stop people tracking your web movement.
So Helen Nissenbaum is a philosopher, essentially, from NYU, and she's worked with Finn Brunton for several years in kind of developing this idea that she has about obfuscation. And they've recently taken some of their online writings and kind of established that into a book. What makes her work interesting is not only does she adopt and together with her colleague, put together kind of a philosophical or a moral argument, but also a political, a technical, and an economic argument about thinking about what it is that obfuscation can add to within this era of surveillance. What's intriguing here is that she's also interested in kind of creating tools, very, very simple low-level tools. In this case, the idea of being able to install a plugin in your browser. She's primarily began originally a couple of years ago, she developed a plugin for the Firefox browser called Track Me Not. And in essence, this was really trying to deal with something that I think has complete relevance and currency today, given what's going on right now in the UK in terms of surveillance laws, or the idea that companies will be required to maintain up to 12 months of your search history for all citizens in the UK. I mean, what does that mean? Why wouldn't we want to use something like Track Me Not, which essentially means that as you're searching for things, it's also generating a whole load of dummy searches for things that you're not looking for. But altogether, it can kind of create a cloak around that makes it impossible to understand really what legitimately were you doing and what were you not doing? What was the algorithm or the little plugin kind of doing on your behalf? And this is an algorithm that also learns over time and adapts. So it becomes, you know, another kind of a clone of you in some ways that's searching the internet for things that you're not interested in at all. But together, they're creating a much more diverse and kind of complicated record of your search history. More recently, she's also been working in collaboration with some colleagues on Ad Nauseam, which is another plugin that's currently for Firefox and will soon be for Google Chrome, that essentially just clicks on all sorts of ads. So the idea that, you know, if you can just kind of click on everything, there's other plugins that also just like everything that they could come across on Facebook. So the idea, if it becomes this kind of undifferentiated mass, that data becomes, it's not very useful to companies if they feel that this person or this entity, this node that they're looking at, seems to just click on absolutely everything. So there's no way they can begin to make inferences about what they do like or what they don't like. It's very hard to target something towards somebody who seems to have absolutely no discerning taste whatsoever.
There's a lot now, a great deal of industry, a great deal of money around knowing what you're looking at on the web and what you respond to. So I wonder, is there a moral question about interfering with all these businesses? Because you have technologies like Tor that will hide what you're doing. You have technologies like Track Me Not, which will send out spurious searches. And on BitTorrent, you have ways of creating lots of false trails to what you're doing. So it seems that with all this going on, people are actually creating a really kind of polluted internet, which might start to be less and less useful to them.
Of course, corporate entities or governments or anybody who feels that there's tremendous value to be found in your data, they're going to take counterstrikes and countermeasures to that. So recently, for example, some researchers, a combination of researchers from France and Australia, began to look at, are there strategies that algorithms or the data mining strategies that companies use that can kind of see within the network that there's clearly a strategy being adopted by a sizable proportion of their user base that warrants a response. So, for example, they looked at social networks, and in particular looking at Facebook. So a very simple thing they did with, if one user within Facebook, for example, starts liking movies, this is the example they looked, liking movies that would point towards that they are perhaps of a different gender. Is there a way that, and they can see that the Facebook algorithm in this case starts beginning to make recommendations or putting ads forward that make assumptions about what gender they think they are based on the movies that they like. This, if you're doing this, if one person does this, you begin to see a huge loss, or a considerable loss, I guess, in the inference engine to about, it's only about 45% accurate. However, if they, in their simulations, if they began and said that 10% of their Facebook user base begins to adopt this strategy, very quickly we see that the inference begins to, the inference algorithms begin to understand that there's something kind of happening here and kind of can adapt to that, and they get back their inference success rate to about 75%. So the authors of this particular piece think like, well, perhaps we want to, you know, that the user base, those again going back to the those was the weak folks out there, that what we really need to do is begin to adapt a dynamic strategy. So it's not enough to do this once, but we need to begin to think over time that like maybe we can play with gender, maybe play a little bit relationship status, maybe you play a little bit around with different aspects of your profile that kind of nudge the algorithm into a different arena. So I think the idea that it's not just something that you do, it's a once-off solution to that, but it's something that people can do that's quite low level, but enough that you feel that you're taking some agency and ownership over your own data.
Professor Aisling Kelleher there, joining us from the internet to offer some strategies for data obfuscation. And next, we're off to Saturn, possibly, in the company of the late great jazz pioneer Sun Ra and his current disciple on Earth, DJ and record label boss Giles Peterson. Officially, Ra was born Herman Poole Blount in Birmingham, Alabama, on May 22, 1914. But after he changed his name to Ra in 1952, he insisted that he was in fact from Saturn. The composer and bandleader headed back in the direction of Saturn in 1993, but since then his legacy has been kept alive by his touring band, The Orchestra, and now by an introductory album curated and mixed by Giles Peterson, who spoke to me about the life, music, and astral voyages of Sun Ra.
I remember when I was growing up in South London, there was a new library that just got built called Sutton Library, and they had a record department, and they had a really good selection of records in there. And I used to go in there and pick up stuff that I kind of recognised and odd records that looked a little bit more interesting. And that's probably when I first saw and listened to Sun Ra, back when I was about 15, 14 years old. I eventually got a couple of his records as I started DJing, and I found that even though I didn't really understand the music particularly, there was always some really good effects and spoken word bits. So I used to use those to sort of link the music I was playing as a DJ. So they were kind of almost jingles. And it wasn't until a bit later on that I really started delving into the music itself. It was actually John Peel that put me onto some of the really early Sun Ra material. Dreaming, 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 dreaming. Here I am, here I am dreaming again. Dreaming, dreaming. I was doing a radio show after him back in the day on Radio 1, and he knew I was a fan. And one night he came into the studio after his show. He didn't often do that. And he just said, I've got a little something for you. And it was an original 7-inch on Saturn of the song called Dreaming. Dreaming, 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 stop me from dreaming. Dreaming, just dreaming, dreaming, oh, you made my dreams come true. Dreaming, just dreaming, it's time for.
I'm always trying to kind of work out what the roots are. You do hear that kind of combination of a world that you sort of know and is familiar and kind of cuddly in a way, but with these kind of shards of something kind of astral breaking through every now and then.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think already there was a use of reverb that he was already interested in that made it already a little bit different. And I believe he was playing keyboards on that song, on Dreaming. So the feeling, if you're really careful and you look into it deeply, you can probably see there's a little connection there and where he went on to from that point And hopefully on the album we touch some of that. I think some of his early jazz records, and already, you know, the use of vocals, limited use of vocals, you could see there was a little bit of that doo-wop in there, but he was already getting into his more spaced out material by then.
Was in some ways led by the instruments, because he was quite interested in what new instruments and new technology might do to his music.
He was the first, or one of the very first, to be experimenting, I believe. It's interesting right now when you go back and you listen to some of the songs and you're like, that was recorded in 1959. That was at least 5 or 6 years ahead of everybody else. So, yeah, I don't know what it was. He was ahead of the game for sure. I don't think he was ever completely accepted by the jazz scene at the time. He was on his own mission, and I think he was just quietly confident that everybody would come round to it at one stage, like we are right now. I mean, this record, funnily enough, it went to the Billboard Top 10 jazz chart in America last week. It's probably the first time he's ever been in the top 10. And it's like, how many records has he made and how long has he been dead for? But
yeah, how dead do you have to be?
Yeah, exactly. But I think he did actually announce on some songs back in the day that people would eventually come around to his music.
Sunrise, love everlasting. In a way, he made it very hard for people to take him seriously within jazz, because he played up the astral side of things, worked so much with costumes, and almost it seemed like deliberately made a kind of an unserious persona for himself.
I remember when he used to come to London, I used to go to see him at Ronnie Scott's. He used to do a residency every year there for a couple of weeks, and I'd make sure I was going to be down there for as many nights as possible. And one of the unsaid rules of signing to my record label, talking out at the time, was to invite all the artists that were about to sign and make sure that they heard Sun Ra, because for me, he presented performance in a new dimension. It wasn't just jazz, it was also theatre, it was also make-believe, and that's possibly why he wasn't taken seriously, but equally it was really something that opened up a whole different audience for him.
I'm always wondering to what degree was he serious about it? I mean, you know, the idea that he used to say he was from outer space himself, and that this mythology he brought around it. At some level, that's good showmanship. But at another level, I wondered how much he believed it.
I think he fully believed it. And I think that there is some otherness about him. I've had so many experiences playing his music or hearing stories from the musicians about being in his band, and it wasn't as much of a myth in a way. I believe that, I mean, you know, obviously I'm not saying that he comes from Saturn, but I think he certainly had sunlight in outer space. A wider view of life, and he had a very visionary view of life. And for me as a DJ, I always carry his music, even if I'm not necessarily going to play it, because it always saves me. If ever I'm going through a moment of doubt in my set, or I'm feeling that I'm losing my focus, I usually play a bit of Sun Ra just to straighten me out a little bit. It's a real... He has that added power somehow. Sunrise in outer space.
Love for everybody. Giles Peterson there, and that album is called Giles Peterson Presents Sun Ra and His Orchestra to Those of Earth and Other Worlds. And with that, it's time to say goodbye to Those of Earth and Other Worlds, as that's all from the current edition of the Culture File Weekly. I was Luke Clancy, and ideally still will be again next week, when we have a brand new file every day at 5:40 on the Daily Culture File, and a fully loaded quiver of files at 6:30 p.m. next Saturday on the Culture File Weekly. Until then, bye now.